So welcome to our podcast. We're going to have a deep dive into the world of cybersecurity and data protection. Today, I'm personally extremely honored and privileged to have one of the industry's most respected leaders in cybersecurity, information security. Please welcome our guest and Chief Information Security Officer at Metal and Boxed.
Hey everyone, glad to be here.
Cool. So I'll kick this off. Thank you very much for coming. Really, really appreciate you giving us some time for this. I know you're a super, super busy man. As you know, I've been out of the cyber world for a few years now. I'm quite keen, and our listeners are keen to understand a little bit around like what has been going on the last few years. What do you think is going to be going forward in the future? What has really changed over the years for yourself that you've seen within the market? And I guess a follow-up question from that is, where do you see cybersecurity and the role of a CISO going in the coming years?
Cool. Yeah, it's a pretty big question. So I guess over the last few years, obviously, it's been a lot of the same. So everyone's still trying to deal with the same challenges in terms of, shift left, vulnerability management, asset management, identity management, all of those things. So all the things that have always been a challenge just are still a challenge. I think in some ways, some of those challenges, especially around things like asset management and vulnerability management, things get easier if you're cloud native and things, because you got a lot of data out the cloud service provider that you might struggle to get out of your own data centers. There's obviously been a continual move to the cloud. We've been talking about it forever, but it's still an ongoing thing. A lot of businesses, especially in regulated industries, are still kind of dipping their toes into cloud, but not necessarily all in with kind of cloud and things. What else has been going on? Obviously, AI everywhere, especially the last year or so, with the kind of regenerative AI being a thing. Automation, I think automation is getting big, getting more traction. I think that's a really important way to kind of force multiply your team and get rid of some of the kind of repeatable drudgeable tasks or drudge tasks, whatever you want to call them. Culture is becoming much bigger, so people are much more realizing security is a people problem. I think no matter whatever it is, it's not just security, right? We're not some special kind of case, but basically whatever it is you're doing, people are always your best allies and your worst problem in many ways, right? So by having the right culture and getting people educated and aware and engaged, you make them your biggest allies. You make them understand why we need to do things securely. You make them understand the benefits and the reasons why we do certain things, and they get much more engaged in what you want to do. Same with your actual security team, right? If I've got an awesome team of people who are really engaged and excited and skilled, I will then naturally get the right processes and the right technology and whatever else out of that, because I've got the right people doing all those things with me, right? So, but if I haven't got the right team, I won't necessarily, no matter what tech I throw at it or what budget we throw at it, you won't necessarily get the right solution. So people are always the most critical part of this puzzle. In terms of what's coming up, I think AI, I've already mentioned that, but it's not going to go away, right? So people are still, I think at the moment it's like a huge hype cycle. It's whatever at the sort of peak of hype of it's going to change everything and the world's going to completely change and everything else, but there's not necessarily that many applications sort of publicly using it. There's some really interesting stuff out there. A lot of people say they're using AI, using ML or kind of other things, right? It's just a bit of a buzzword, but I think it will become more and more accepted, and people will work out how to use it safely. So a lot of the challenges with it are around accuracy of results, poisoning that giving it weird inputs and prompts attacks and that kind of thing. So there's a whole new range of security and privacy and safety things we now need to learn and understand, so that if we do use AI for anything that's kind of like impactful, especially to sort of customers and things, you have to start thinking about all of the things you do to make sure that it's not biased, you understand its workings, it can tell you why it's come to a certain outcome, all of those things. There's a whole kind of new skill set we need to then build and learn around doing that safely. We'll continue to see more automation, especially while kind of the economy's a bit strange and budget challenges, whatever else, right? The more we can automate and the more we can kind of make repeatable, the more you can kind of grow your capability without having to say I need more money and more people constantly. So I think, yeah, automation, AI, culture will, I hope, continue to be a really important thing that we focus on. And again, with the kind of culture piece and organizational culture, the better we do at that, the more you have engagement from product teams and other bits of the business, who the more they understand the why of security and how we can help them do things safely and fastly, safely and quickly. Fastly is terrible. I'm advertising another company there. The more it benefits them and the more it benefits their company, the easier it is to kind of do that shifty left piece and get more secure product built, right? You'll never not need security at the front end, because no matter how securely you build your thing, it's going to interact with other stuff. You're going to have people with access to data. You're going to have mistakes. You're going to have trade-offs, all of those things. No matter how well you do, you're still going to need, I think, some security at the front end as well. But you can massively reduce your risk by getting your organization engaged and doing things securely throughout that kind of design and build lifecycle as well.
You've come from, you've worked in quite a few different industries, right? So have you seen much change within those industries, coming from, you know, food, beverage tech, food to banking, fintech effectively? Obviously banking, et cetera, is a lot more regulated, but have you seen much change in the way that people process technology is kind of has a focus, or has maybe a higher relevance to the board in the different industries you've worked in?
I mean, obviously it's every company has a risk appetite of some sort, right? Any company that says they don't have a risk appetite is lying, because it's not just security risk, right? You go into a new market, or you invest in a new product that could fail, or whatever else. Right? Companies all do things with a risk lens on them. I think where you have stuff that has huge value and huge impact, there is more of a focus on security, just because of the value of what you're protecting. But also it has its downsides in terms of the amount of regulation you have. Actually, I fundamentally think slows people down. I think a good security team in a less regulated industry with support from their organization will deliver a lot more security a lot more quickly than in regulated industries. I think regulators need to have a real think about the fact that you're actually slowing innovation, slowing security under the banner of creating better security, right? But equally, because it is regulated, you have all these mandatory things that you need to do to meet the regulation. So security is always front of mind, both from a it's the right thing to do and like regulating legal requirements. So I think, yeah, it should be down to what assets you're protecting, right? So you should have, your organization should have a reasonably well articulated risk appetite and should understand the value of its assets, and then have appropriate security controls, processes, tech, whatever in place to protect those assets, and also understanding threat landscape as well. So I think that's the thing that changes probably the most. Wow. You know, organizations, especially kind of obviously startups, do loads of new things, but there's a lot of organizations that have been in banking or pharmaceuticals or supermarkets or whatever for years, and they'll continue to do that for years because that's their space, right? And that's what they're good at. Mm-hmm. And the regulations gradually evolve, but they don't change like this. But things like, again, it's a shame to keep mentioning it because it's a buzzword, but things like game-changing things like ML and AI, or, you know, new attacks or new zero days, whatever else, new ways of doing things for criminals, the threat landscape changes an awful lot and changes much more quickly than other things. So I think it's not just about what does your organization need to do now, it's about kind of understanding what the threats are out there as well. So you manage risk and you manage vulnerabilities and whatever else, but you also need to have a really good eye on what the threats are to your environment and who's interested in getting hold of your information. Which I think also touches on supply chain stuff, right? So everyone spends a huge amount of time thinking about their suppliers and doing supply chain security and all that stuff, and which is always a challenge. But organizations should also be aware of what they're in the supply chain for. So if you're providing goods and services to other people, you potentially become a target if you being impacted could impact them. So if you're a key critical supplier to someone else, you might be fairly small, but you're a critical supplier to a large business or business that may have, you know, people wanting to cause harm to it. They might think, actually, that large business has got a load of security in place, but here's, look at their supply chain. What suppliers could we impact them? So be very cognizant of, as you grow and as you have different customers, you could be attacked because of your customers or who you're supplying, not because you're of what you have directly.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's, you're saying from both sides, it's utilizing technology that's available, the people available to really empower the business to make sure that they can kind of reduce the risk and, you know, do something about the threats that are coming in. That it's never ever going to stop. So from our kind of side, we're very focused around the you know, zero days, the external threats, the attack surface. How do you see that, or have you seen that kind of evolve over the years? InfoSec, I think I saw some companies talking about AI as part of an LLM. I think a large company quite some time ago were talking about it. Do you see much of an impact in the short term? What are your thoughts around that kind of part of the cybersecurity industry and how that's maybe changed over the years and where it may be going.
So you're talking kind of threat intel, attack surface, pen testing stuff.
Yeah. So the internal, external threats.
Yeah. So I think from a, obviously, yeah, threat intel is really useful. I think a lot of places you get threat intel and it's generic stuff, which is, yeah, it's fine. You know, a bunch of IOCs are useful to look for and things, but it's threat intel needs to be much more targeted to have that real value. We all know bad people are trying to do bad things, right? But when are they talking about your company? When's, is there an attack imminent on your company? Are people talking about, you know, if they found your company's emails or password on the dark web, that kind of stuff, right? So you want threat intel that is some general stuff, and here's a whole bunch of IOCs to throw in your SIM, whatever else. Great, good news. But you also want to kind of make sure, if you're doing, going down that road, you get some tailored threat intel that's very much focused on your organization, your keywords that you've given them. So, you know, what are the latest secret projects, that kind of stuff, so you know if there's leaks of IP or whatever else getting out there. More generally, I think it's not that I'm against pen testing, but I think pen testing is very, very misused. So for me, a pen test is kind of a belt and braces. Let's have a quick look at your whatever you're about to go live or in production and kind of go, have you done the SDLC right? Have we got any low hanging fruit? Because the reality is, right, no matter how good a pen tester is, you have a few pen testers looking at your thing for 5 days, 10 days, whatever it is, right? There's a limit to what they can do. So they're only going to be really hitting a very small subset of what you can potentially do. Whereas an attacker might spend weeks, months, even years, if it's enough value, researching your organization, understanding your tech stack, looking for vulnerabilities and trying different things. So I think they have value, but they should be seen much more of a quick check to make sure we've not missed anything obvious, as opposed to, are we secure because we had a pen test? The SDLC is garbage. There's not enough protection in prod, but we had a pen test that didn't find anything in 5 days, right? Doesn't mean secure. It just means it wasn't anything obvious. Yep. So I am, though, a big fan of the continuous testing model. No idea if you guys do that or not, but the kind of where you have, especially if it's like crowdsourced, so it's not one person, it's a group of people, because that I think replicates only from kind of an external attack perspective, not like a kind of a red team or social engineering, but in terms of your external facing app or website or whatever your server APIs, whatever they are, I as an individual or I as a criminal can spend time knocking on the door and trying different things and downloading the app and trying to get it to run on a jailbroken phone and trying to talk to your API and seeing if I could take a certificate out of one of your apps and talk to it with something else and whatever else I'm trying to do, right? I can spend time doing all of that. So by having a continuous testing model where you get people who via whatever method are incentivized to keep trying, they get to know more and more about your system, your app, your service, whatever. And it's much more of a realistic, I spent, you know, 3 months looking at it. Oh, they've done a new release. What's changed? Let's see if I can needle at that. So that's much more, I think, a replica of an external hacker or cracker, criminal, whatever you want to call them, than a kind of point-in-time pen test. And it means you don't have to have that panic of, oh, about to go live, we've done a pen test, because you're just having it constantly tested, right? So yeah. I think there's huge benefits, obviously a cost associated with that, but for kind of key things, I think continuous testing is much better than pen testing. I think red teams are also very important from the point of view of they look at other things, right? So you'll give a red team company, your goal is to get prod data or to put through a dodgy transaction or whatever it happens to be, right? And they obviously can't do certain things, so it's still not fully realistic. They can't kidnap people or blackmail people or, you know, those kind of things that criminals can do. Yes, and certainly they can't, and they're not going to want to destroy anything, so they're not going to be ransomwareing you and DDoSing you and stuff, right? So there are rules of engagement that makes a red team not the same as an adversary, but it does help you find, oh, why is that person in marketing got access to prod? Because they just clicked on a link and suddenly they've downloaded prod data from a marketing laptop or something like that, right? So you can find the gaps that a pen test wouldn't find that are much more kind of realistic of how people are going to get in. Because there's different stats for everyone, right? Everyone's got, so who sells a product has got a stat that says their product fixes the most important issue, right? But there's a huge amount of attacks actually are social engineering or phishing, smishing, phone calls, dumpster diving, walking into the office, all those things are not necessarily, I've SQL injected you, because people are, majority of companies are on top of a lot of the OWASP things, right? But they're not necessarily on top of everyone having a perfectly patched laptop that only has access to the minimum amount of things that requires you to 2FA or YubiKey or something, any kind of serious access for every single case for every single user in your company. So they find those holes. So I think red team's really important. I'm a huge fan of the purple teaming concept as well, where, you know, for those who aren't familiar, purple teaming and blue teams are defenders, red teams are attackers, blend the two, you get purple, right? So lots of companies go, oh, we have to do a red team in super secret and the security team doesn't know about it so we can test all the things, which does have some value. But you can actually do it. If you do a red team the security team does know about, yes, right, they know it's coming, but they'll still, you'll still have evidence of did they detect it or not, right? So it's not like you can hide whether we detected stuff, but you're sitting with the testers effectively. And every time they do things, they're like, oh, we did this. Did you see it? Oh, no. Oh, this is how we can change it. So you can actually make real improvements to your security posture, because every time that the red team has tried a new thing or send a new phishing email or try and run a certain thing on a host or whatever they're doing, you can see did you detect it or not, and you can find those gaps, and the blue team get to learn. So I think purple teaming is very underrated and underused. It's obviously a bit costly in terms of time and effort, but I think that's a huge thing to look at. In terms of AI and LLM, I guess you see this kind of like this future where you've got the criminal AI and the defense AI, and who's got the best AI model defending, right? And it's, you know, it could get down that route, and obviously criminals are using them. I think what's it called, Worm GPT or something. There's already kind of explicitly criminal versions of ChatGPT, and it's also, again, going back to that prompt injection-y kind of stuff, you can often ask good, in inverted commas, LLMs questions in a certain way, like, I'm writing a book about this, or those kind of things. You're probably better to be more simple now, but
yeah, you can ask questions actually
in a certain way, then it will still give you the naughty answer because it thinks it's for a book or for a research or whatever. So you can often get around the things that try and stop them doing that. And I think with all these things, from a defender's point of view, they can help with kind of contextualizing alerts and getting better at correlating between different disparate sources, because they can apply it. You can apply a bit more intelligence to those things. So I think, yeah, we'll see a continued benefit to both defense and attack from AI things. I think one of the most interesting ones that I've been kind of having a bit of a nose around is where it's going and kind of things we're not really talking about. So everyone's talking about AI from, you know, the LLMs and ChatGPTs, but if you look at some of the things, like there's a really interesting YouTube about battlefield AI from Palantir, but they're also, yeah, there's companies like that that are doing really interesting but potentially scary things with AI helping identify targets in battlefields and that kind of stuff, which then gets you to the can I then fall that AI into this hospital looking like a missile site so it gets bombed, or vice versa, so you don't attack the missile site, those kind of things. So then attacking AI and fooling AI becomes like a really serious business. So I think it's those things, and there's the things they've done, I think, I can't remember, it's with AI to detect cancer as well, and just by changing some of the pixels in the picture, it can detect that it is either benign or not benign and those kind of things. So there's a really, outside of kind of the traditional security stuff, I think there's a huge, I've gone a bit off a tangent, but I think with the AI and attacking and defending piece, there's a very big thing around what AI should and shouldn't be doing, and also when it's doing things that are life and death. You know, if AI gives me a crappy code snippet in Git or sends me to the wrong help thing in a website and I have to do a bit more kind of clicking around to find the right answer, not the end of the world. If it misdiagnoses a cancer or misidentifies a hospital as a missile site or something else, end of the world for some people, right? So I think where it's the sort of more serious end of AI gets you into really, really interesting space around how you detect it and make sure it's always, well, I can't say always, but as accurate as possible.
Yeah. I think there's, with any new technologies coming on, any changes, there's always the one pit that people focus on, that's actually where else can that go and what can that impact? And yeah, it's a very interesting area of where it's going and how we can utilize it. I'm just going to jump back to your point around, I think a lot of when you were talking about the attack vectors, it's very much around the collaboration. So you mentioned the red, the blue, etc. And actually working with customers. So there's a term that we use here called pen testing as a service. And that's kind of goes into that area of like, how do you then collaborate with your customer to make sure that you're reducing that threat exposure and kind of doing continuous work. And I think that's what I've maybe from my side of things, from the commercial side over the years, seen a lot of focus on, okay, you come in, you do this effectively audit, this tick box, it needs to be done as regulation based. As you say, we've made a change, we need to make sure, but actually the longer term value working with from both sides, the partnership is, we're going to deliver more value to you as a customer if we have more exposure, we get to know you more, we're collaborating, and you know, we are both using technology to make it easier for us to reduce the risk to the business, and obviously ultimately kind of help you achieve your goals and again from the commercial side achieving our goals. So It's really interesting you go down that collaborative route, because all technology come out, but it kind of starts and ends with the human engagement.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree. I think, you know, I spoke about this recently on LinkedIn and stuff as well. It's that partnership model. I'd much rather have a very limited number of companies that I work with that are much more partners, right? Because it goes both ways, and it's they get to learn more about you, whether it's pen testing or whatever, right? The more they understand about your business, the more they can come provide contextual help rather than just general, here's some advice or here's our tooling or whatever else. And yeah, selfishly, from a buyer's point of view or a customer's point of view, less people to deal with is less, you know, less people to deal with, less renewals and less whatever else. But it's also, you tend to get that better service as well. You know, if you've worked with a company for a few years, or you've got some, you know, people in there that are, like, you know, more than just kind of client, you know, customer kind of client kind of people, they're much more kind of, you know, almost friends in terms of you chat about things generally and catch up on, you know, email or whatever else. When you need that thing that's like, ah, oh, damn it, we've got to get this done by tomorrow. Can you quickly get me a statement of work together or help me out with this? They're much more likely to, because you've got that relationship built up, in the same way as when they're like, hey, would you mind having a quick call with a potential customer and you know, talking through what we've done with you or whatever else? It kind of goes both ways. So you both get a lot more out of it. And yeah, it's easier to manage. And I think, I don't know what the stat is, there's some crazy stat like 60 or 80% of all security tools aren't properly configured and stuff, right? So that going out and buying best of breed of everything from a whole bunch of different people might sound awesome if you've got like an infinite size security team to make sure they're all configured perfectly and on every endpoint and in every bit of the network they should be and whatever else. But actually, you're much better off getting things that are kind of broader spectrum and easier to manage. And like, it might be the 80% solution, but it's configured properly. That's going to be better than the 100% solution that's not configured, right? So, okay. So having that kind of slightly less smooth, more simplified security estate with some tooling that has kind of multiple capabilities, I think it's hugely beneficial, or like it's already in use. So is it Sona? I always get them confused, Sonatype or Sonacube. Sonacube, which is as another example, it's a tool devs use for like code quality and other stuff, but it's got kind of SaaS kind of capabilities in it as well, right? So if they're already using that, you'd be completely foolish to go, oh, well, I've got a 10% better SaaS tool, so you've got to use a whole new tool. Just use the tool they're using. So think about what your environment is as well, and kind of minimize that complexity, but also minimize the amount of tools that your internal customers have to use. Because if you're a security team, so, right, you need 15 agents on every laptop. Devs, here's your SaaS tool and your SCA tool and your DAS tool and this tool that you've got to run as part of the SDLC. And it's all completely madness, as opposed to, oh, here's one tool that does SaaS and SCA, and you can use it for some of your code quality stuff as well that you're already using. Awesome, right? Minimizes that complexity. So I think having that kind of, there's so many benefits to minimizing how many different tools you've got and how many different businesses you have to work for with, that I think, yeah, the kind of the partnership model is amazing. It's hard though. It's hard on both sides. It's hard for vendors, because you want to sell stuff, and I get that, and you want to, you know, chase people up to get leads and get sales. While at the same time not pissing them off, to find that balance. And then for people on my side, it's really hard because we haven't got any time. So you spent time to build those relationships, and yeah, it takes longer than it should, because it's like, I can't talk to every vendor and I can't talk to everyone who contacts me. And maybe even someone, I think I used the example, it might be even the right tool at the right time, but you're just going to go with something you know because you're rushed, right? So, you know, I gave an example. I think if, you know, I might walk into a new company and, you know, if they had nothing in place at all, I might go, right, I'm going to need to get an EDR tool in ASAP just because of nothing on the endpoints at all. But I need one that's going to do that 24/7 response and stuff, triage for me, because I've got no SecOps people yet either, right? So, and I need it to be really quick and easy. So it might be that someone from an EDR vendor contacts me that day and says, hey, you're talking about this. And it's like, in a normal circumstance, I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to look at a few different vendors. But because I'm in a circumstance where I haven't built my team yet, I've got some huge risks to deal with, I'll just go, and in my last company, I rolled out X and it worked really well and went across like thousands of endpoints, caused me no problems. I know their service back inside out. I know how they deal with incidents. I'll probably just go with that one because I need to get something done and I can't risk putting in a new thing that then causes me more problems rolling out. So it is really hard. I recognize it's hard for people selling, because even when you do have that fortuitous right time, right product, right email, I might be in a position where I'm like, I'd love to, but I can't risk something I don't know, right? So you know, there is so many things that have to align to get that right in place. So although we all moan about it, I do fully recognize that CISOs and security teams and businesses need vendors with solutions, whatever they are, whether that's people or process or tech solutions. But it's hard when everyone's busy to find that balance of how is it best to contact people and how is it best to kick things off? Because, you know, the completely limited contact I want probably wouldn't get you enough sales if you did that to everyone. But yeah, so I haven't got the full answers, but it's a space that I think everyone recognizes. Everyone needs each other, but how do we do it without annoying each other, and how do we do it in a way that builds those kind of relationships so you know you're both going to get good value from it?
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of, we're talking about collaboration, but like a lot of community-led engagements nowadays, like people being part of different groups or having existing relationships, or you know, not having to kind of go out and get those new things, or actually if they do have something new, it's then referenced in from somebody else, which kind of like de-risks it in a sense. Because I guess the hardest part within your job is you have a bunch of risks you need to work on, a bunch of priorities, and actually using the solutions you already know and love and know, you know, that work inside out, but also being open and being able to have a visibility on the market of what's new and the innovative stuff that comes across. Massive challenging times. But I really appreciate your post, as I commented the other day, it's nice to see that there's people like yourselves who engage with the buyer, engage with the sellers, you know, what's good, what's not good, just to then share that, because it can be, it's not easy on both sides, right? So everyone's got a lot to do, everyone's rushed, everyone's getting, you know, making money to make ends meet, etc. But actually having that very positive approach, you know, a really nice of, this is what you could do, this is what you shouldn't do, to help advise people, because some people are getting into it, they're new, and maybe they may be doing things wrong. So that's really, really good. You don't have to share that information, and you're actually helping the part of the industry which is, you know, kind of funding, right? Like the business you work for, there'll be people out there who are, you know, actively selling, actively looking for new customers in XYZ different ways, and actually sharing that positive message was really lovely to see. What I wanted to, we've talked a good bit about the kind of areas we wanted to cover today. Is there anything else you wanted maybe talk about before my final question?
No, the only thing I was going to add, I realised that for those who followed it, that post I did about kind of do's and don'ts, I totally forgot one thing on the do, which is do your research. So that's the other thing. And it saves you time, right? Because you won't be emailing people about stuff or chasing people about stuff that's irrelevant to them. You know, the company I work for is entirely cloud native from when it was born. And I've had numerous emails or sales contacts about digital transformation and cloud migrations and those kind of things. So like, come on, we're pretty publicly cloud native. So do a little bit, I know it takes more time, but if you email me about stuff like that, it's like you clearly haven't looked at what I'm doing at all. And if you email me something that's totally relevant to what we're doing, you've got a much better chance of me replying if I need that thing right. So just don't waste your time emailing people about stuff that's irrelevant to them or very clearly irrelevant to them based on their tech stack or their industry or whatever else. That's one thing I realized that after I put it up, I'd run out of space to type in it, but I was like, damn it, I should put in do your research as well. So there, that's an extra one for exclusive for this recording.
There's always one more, isn't there? Yeah. There's one more. There was a insurance company I was working with, quite an innovative fund. They told me that they ended up putting their tech stack online, so you can kind of see what sort of things they're using and see how you could then fit into our environment and then help that research. Coming from setting KPIs and building sales teams, there's that delicate balance between, you know, hitting the number but then actually being targeted and having the right research. And I totally agree, you need to go in, the more information you have, the more you know, the better chance you'll have of actually having a conversation that's beneficial for both sides, rather than throwing, you know, mud against the wall and hoping something sticks.
Yeah.
So thank you for the advice that you've given from the to the sales and commercial side of the industry out there. What my last question, I'd love to hear your thoughts on, or actually your comments around, so let me start that one again. Thank you very much for telling us around, sorry.
Just take a moment, mate.
Sorry, got carried away. I just got, yeah, the other ones are fine. I just got nervous with this one myself, but anyway, we'll cut that bit out. So thank you very much for sharing the advice, you know, for the sales side, the commercial side. I'm quite keen to, and our listeners will be quite keen to hear, you know, you've had a pretty amazing journey. What advice would you give to the younger you or the up and coming CISOs of the world for their next steps and, you know, as they aspire to be in a similar position?
Well, yeah, I guess a few things. One's that being a CISO isn't a be-all and end-all. So don't feel, just because it's like the chief security dude person, sorry, that you should aspire to that, right? If you love technical stuff or you love being in the weeds of security operations and dealing with incidents and you know, that kind of sort of slightly more seat your pants end of the world, whatever else, you can be really senior in security, heading up a massive security operations team or leading a pen test of operations or leading red teams or whatever else, or even, you know, leading, you know, I always have a culture lead if I can get it approved in my team as well. So you can lead really big chunks of really important bits of security without being a CISO. So don't kind of think that's where you should aim if it's not where you want to be. I know there's quite a few engineers in that I've worked with before that want to become really awesome at what they do and like principal or distinguished or whatever engineers, and you can do really well financially and have huge impact, you know, depending what your motivation is doing that, right? So I guess my first thing is it's not the be all and end all. If you become a CISO, you will not be hands-on. Any company that's advertising for a hands-on CISO doesn't want a CISO, they want a senior engineer or something, but they need the title for investment or whatever else, right? So CISO is not a hands-on role. Doesn't mean it can't be technical, but doesn't mean it has to be technical either. And that's, I guess, the other part is, there's many routes here, right? So if you do want to be senior in security, whatever that is, there's a million routes to do that, especially in the less technical. So if you're in more of a GRC or CISO or culture lead or whatever else, you need to understand people and business and other things like that, and a bit about budgeting and strategy and all those things. There's a whole bunch of things that you need that aren't security specific, right? Yeah, and there's, you know, I know for me, probably, you know, I love CISOing, but I might move to CIOing or CTOing at some point because that has security and other stuff, or often does anyway. So yes, there's no one route. You can get here from many, many different routes. If you're not in security now, think about what you want to do. Obviously, if you're doing a career change, same as any career change, be realistic. If you're on 100K as something really awesome that has nothing to do with security, you might not earn 100K in your first security job or whatever, you know. So if you are really senior at something, you don't necessarily jump across to the same thing, especially if you want to kind of move from a non-technical to a technical role or something. If you're more junior, I can't recommend SecOps highly enough. I think doing, if you're, especially if you're not 100% sure, like if you're a super hardcore dev and you want to come and work in AppSec or whatever else, awesome. But if you want to be, if you like security or you find security really interesting and security research interesting, whatever else, security operations is a great place to start. Because you will see a bit of everything, right? You'll see a bit of all of your organization. You'll learn about threats. You'll learn about attacks. You'll learn about incident response. You will learn a little bit about application stuff, because if you've got a decent AppSec function, they'll be talking to you about what's coming and app changes. And especially if there's something going live with any risks, you're aware of what the risks are and whatever else in live. You'll learn a bit about infrastructure security, because you have to understand endpoint protection and data protection and all those things. So if you're kind of newish to security or you're not sure what you're going to do a stint in security operations or something similar, because you'll see a bit of everything. And then you go, oh, I really like this application, web applications attacking things and what's going on there. I'll go and learn a bit more about AppSec. Or I love data and understanding what data we've got where. So I'll go and do some more data security research and learning. So it'll give you that opportunity to move into multiple other roles. And if you are not in a security thing and you want to move into it, think about what you could offer, right? So again, it was quite a while ago now, but I had a question once around, someone asked, you know, how would they get into security? And I asked what they did, and they were in, I can't remember, it was in marketing or design or something. So something where they'd be great at doing design work and other things. So I said, well, come to me and talk to me about how you will help me have the best presentations the board's ever seen, right? You know, and how you'll help me kind of present security to engineers, whatever else. So if even when you've got a completely non-security skill set, if you're great at design or you're super organized or you're brilliant at budgets, there's going to be things you can bring that I may not have and my team might not have. So think about what your skills are and what those skills could do to help a team sell what they're doing, because security, we've got to sell to the rest of the business. Or, you know, no one likes budgets, but if you're brilliant at budgets or you're brilliant at planning, you know, a lot of security teams don't have enough size or resource to have like a project manager or a project, you know, program director or whatever in their team. So if you're really organized and great at project management and want to learn security, go, well, do you need some hand having your program fully captured in a beautiful kind of you know, project plan and tracking where we are against our deliverables and all those things, which is awesome for me because I have to send out regularly on where we are with that plan, right? So you know, you don't have to have security skills to be able to bring an awful lot of things to the team. So just have a think about what you could bring. Talk to people, network, you know, sounds cliched, right? But go to a few events, get chatting to people about what they're doing, you know, talk to people about the fact that you want to get into the industry. Because if I've chatted to you a couple of times and I know you're really keen, even if I haven't got a job, if a colleague or you know, someone I know in the industry is like, hey, I'm looking for someone to do this, I'm like, oh, Jane spoke to me the other day. She was really keen on that sort of thing. And I could intro you. So yeah, I guess there's no one route. Think about what your skills could do to help a team, because security isn't all technology. It's, you know, as we touched on, people, process, budgeting, selling, project planning. There's a whole range of things that we have to do as part of a security team to achieve our goals. Influencing people, culture and awareness and engagement, all those things. There's, you know, psychology. If you're good at psychology, you're going to understand people's mindsets, both from an education point of view and how do attackers think or what drives attackers, whatever else, right? So think about those different ways in. Network and go to some events. Realize that CISOing isn't the be all and end all. It's one job amongst a lot of different jobs. You know, in a bigger company, there'll be people with lower and inverted commas titles than me that probably earn more and have more people working for them, because it's just a bigger organization, right? So yeah, it's not about necessarily being a CISO, about what are you most passionate about, because you're going to be doing this for 40, 50, 60 hours a week, right? So find the bits you're most keen on within security and smash those. Don't just go, hey, I want to do management and budgets, because it's not, you know, I love my job, don't get me wrong, but it's not, I'm nowhere near as hands-on as I used to be. And I guess the other thing is, as you're building teams and growing up through your career, understand your weaknesses. So if you are from a super technical background, maybe as you build a team, make sure you've got some people who are really strong on like GRC and risk and planning and things, who can help you with the other bits. If you're from a non-technical background, you might be really good at strategy and talking to the board, but you don't really understand what's going on from a technical standpoint. So make sure you have some really trusted people in the team to help you understand the technical aspects.
Yeah, amazing. So very much around, you know, be passionate, find something you love. And even if you're not in the industry, there will be something that you can really add value to that business, and yeah, follow that and see where it gets you.
Yeah, no, I generally believe, and especially that passion, but you don't have to be passionate to be great at your job, but I would really struggle turning up every day to do a job that I didn't like doing, right? So find things that you enjoy doing.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you very much.
No worries.